Good morning. Welcome to a special setting of Division 6 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We've got one case scheduled on the 10 a.m. docket, Scoggins versus Encompass Insurance. I see counsel are present and ready to proceed. Let me first apologize to counsel and the parties. I know we had a setting on this some weeks ago, and unfortunately our courthouse was closed, and so I apologize again. I hope you all weren't terribly inconvenienced, but we appreciate you being here today for this resetting. You should have all received a set of written instructions detailing our oral argument procedures. Let me just ask if any counsel have any questions about those procedures or the instructions before we start. Thanks. Okay, if not, we'll go ahead and proceed to hear argument in Scoggins. I would remind counsel and anybody in the audience, if you've got a cell phone or a pager or something like that, please turn it off now so as not to disrupt oral arguments. Counsel, if you please, when you come to the podium, identify yourself by name and attorney registration number. And with that, we are ready to hear the argument.
Good morning. My name is Rob Carey, registration number 17177, on behalf of Dennis Scoggins. This appeal presents two issues. One, was Mr. Scoggins deprived of his right to a jury? And second, was did the court err in concluding that the defendant did not violate 10-4-7-10, the statute that requires insurers to offer enhanced PIP coverage? Let me start just briefly with the jury issue. The jury issue is pretty well briefed, but I just want to explain the context so the court understands it. What happened was, in the context of a motion to bifurcate, plaintiff said in his opposition to the motion, here's how we would arrange the trial, putting fact issues with fact issues and trying to do those first, saying we will argue these to the jury. There was never anything in the plaintiff's opposition that related to whether or not you had a right to a jury trial, the merits of that question. It was simply aligning phases of the trial. The defendant in its reply stated in a section captioned, the appropriate way to do it is to do it in equity, argues that, and then the court makes a decision on it. So plaintiff never was heard on the merits of the issue. So we go along and then we sort of realize this, but at that point they have, according to the defendant even, because they concede in their motion that really plaintiff's motion for reinstatement of a jury trial was an untimely motion for reconsideration. So they understand the court ruled on that issue. So, but the plaintiff brought it forward because they never were heard on the merits. That's the only reason. So we thought because it wasn't analyzed in the order and we never had an argument on the merits, we thought we'd ask the court to reconsider, and we did, and the court did reconsider. And the court found we had a right to a jury trial. But he found we judicially or constructively waived it, rather, because of participation in, I guess, either through delay or participation in status reports. And so the issue really is, did the court waive it because it was a matter of convenience or because it was a matter of actual waiver? We argued it, we lost on the motion, we asked for reconsideration. I think it's pretty clear plaintiff never gave up his right to a jury trial. Second would be, there's three prongs to the issue on the 10-4-7-10 violation. One is that there's a different insurer involved here, and the trial court gave credit to the second insurer for acts of the first insurer. The other is the defects in the policy, and lastly is the manner in which the agent made the offer. So let me address those, and I'll really focus for the most part on the third prong. But on the first prong, the court found that it was uncontradicted that Glens Falls, the insurer that had the policy that covered the accident, took over the assets and liabilities of the first insurer, CNA. There's no evidence in the record on that. In fact, the only evidence in the record is that they didn't know what the relationship was between Glens Falls and the others. What was uncontradicted was that Allstate...
Can I interrupt you for a minute?
Absolutely.
Who is the they that you're referring to? You said they didn't know. Who's the they you're referring to?
Well, Allstate has an arm called Encompass, which is the administrator. And the administrator worked on both of these insurers' policies. And so, when I say they, I mean the only witness for the defendant at the trial that had any knowledge whatsoever of corporate structure or how it came to be that Glens Falls ended up with Ms. Scoggins' policy. They had one person on there, Ms. Jancic, and she testified she had no personal knowledge of how they got the policy. What she knew was Allstate took over CNA's lines. So we don't know whether it's a joint venture, a marketing relationship, a stock purchase, an asset purchase. We have no idea what it is. And
Counsel, does that really matter if the policy really remains unchanged, if the numbers and the substance, and does it matter how it came to change hands if the changing of hands occurred and everything remained the same?
I think it does matter. The statute says every insurer, when issuing a policy, shall make that offer. So one, this plain language says it, they have to do it. Second, they obviously changed forms. I mean, keep in mind, this agent used a form that was not certified for use, and I'm going to come to that because it's not a technical issue. It's an issue of mixing one form from a set with other forms from a set where something gets lost in the shuffle. And so it does matter because every insurer is different. They have different practices, different reserves, different ratings, and they use some forms, but remember the second insurer changed the form in the second year of the policy. So, yeah, I think it does matter. Second, the trial court erred on concluding that there was no defect in the policies. He called it an alleged omission and found that it was appropriate as a matter of law, that there was no omission of pedestrians or passengers as a matter of law. And I would just point out, this is an admitted violation. This isn't like the cases where you're not sure whether they cover them. First, the plain language of the policy excludes people from coverage. Second, the agent conceded she understood those people were excluded from coverage. Third, the Brennan notice they sent out specifically stated that the former policy did not provide coverage to pedestrians and passengers. And most importantly, and I'm going to provide the site on this, Exhibit 6 with Bates numbers ENC2914, they say the enhanced PIP provides coverage for named insureds and a resident child, and they cite to the reduced PIP section of the No-Fault Act. That's fundamentally different from every PIP policy out there. Resident relatives get coverage under all basic PIP policies, and that's 10470312, which defines resident relatives, which is your grandmother, somebody by blood, adoption, marriage, your uncle, your brother, everybody. They all get coverage on your PIP. A resident child for purposes of reduced PIP gets coverage only if he's a dependent on the tax return. There's no coverage for all the other panoply of resident relatives that would get coverage. So they misstate what the law would require them to do anyway.
Can I, just from a practical standpoint, my understanding is that the plaintiff here was covered. The question was there going to be the additional PIP? So what's, even assuming that you're correct, what's the effect on this case? Why does it matter if there was such an omission, if the omission didn't have anything to do with coverage for this particular plaintiff?
Well, that raises two things. One, I would say that the site I just gave you for that document has something to do with him because he's a stepchild.
But he was covered. I mean,
he was covered for basic PIP. The issue is on the offer of enhanced PIP, did they make it clear what the coverage actually is under the law and the policy so you can make an informed decision? If somebody said to you, hey, I have this great coverage, and it covers nobody that you actually care about and gives you no extra benefit, and it's expensive, but it doesn't exclude the person, and you would have bought it otherwise if it was explained correctly, but you declined purchase, and then somebody comes in and says, you made a really terrible offer to that person. The Colorado law is we don't look at whether you would have bought it. The sole issue is whether, one, the process was reasonably calculated to lead to an informed decision. And if it's not, and you violate the statute, then you have to incorporate all of the coverages at the highest level into the policy. It's not a, if you start going about, look at the defect and only fix the defect, you're going to run into problems. Because a lot of times you will say something, the Parfrey case is a very good one. If you just slightly give too little information such that you violate the statute, nothing's incorrect, but you don't give enough information, what do you fix? You fix the policy. Everybody would get coverage. You don't figure out where they erred on giving too little and fix it for that person. If you offer no wage loss, you have to give medicals and wage loss because the only way to get medicals and wage loss is to buy them both. You can't buy just wage loss. So I think Colorado law is pretty clear to say we're not going to look at speculate as to whether they would have bought it. The only issue is, did you make an offer that's sufficient to make an informed decision? I would go a step further and say, Parfrey says this. Parfrey says, you have to do more than merely make that coverage available. You have to make it in a way that allows for an informed decision. That presupposes that the coverage exists. So these defects are important. And if you look at the Clark case, the Brennan case, they didn't go figure out who talked to who. They just said, look, it's not in the policy. You read it into the, it's not in the policy, so we're going to read it into the policy. And cases out there have never, I mean, I've seen some recently, and I'm sure Mr. Vaught will tell you more about this on some unpublished cases, but I think Colorado law is pretty solid on the fact that if you violate the statute, you automatically incorporate the coverages that should have been offered. With that, let me turn to what I think is the biggest problem that they have, defendant has. What the agent did was she took a form from a third-party vendor that sells to smaller carriers, and she used that form. And if you look at that form, Exhibit 2, you'll see it contemplates a no-fault application being tendered with the application as well as a supplemental application. Well, we only have the supplemental application and the application. So she pulls a form from the Accord group, doesn't look at what the actual Glens Falls set of documents has, and what got left out here is the backbone of understanding PIP, which is the form required by 10-4706-4A. The Munger case said it. You have to provide a written explanation of PIP coverages. You will never find in anywhere in this record anything that says, here's what PIP is. You get $50,000 in medicals. You get $50,000 in rehab. You can roll your rehab over to get $100,000 in medicals. Basic wage loss is 100% for a certain amount, then 70%, then 60%, up to $400 per week. Medical allows you to get non-medical care. It allows you to get vocational rehab under basic PIP. That's never explained. It's never explained because they because she pulled the Accord application out, which had another document that should go with it, and put it with the set that might have had its PIP explanation in the actual application that was certified for use or in another form that she didn't use. But she testified, I've never used that form ever. Look through the case law on these cases. All the insurers have them. They're required by law. The same thing on the 10-4-111 form. It's a summary disclosure form. It has to be given at the front end. She's never used that. They didn't get it. So all of the things that would allow you to make an informed decision, to understand what PIP is, never got to her. On top of that, the agent had virtually no understanding of the fundamental differences between basic PIP and enhanced PIP. One is stackable, the other's not. They both apply to your, to you personally. So if you're in someone else's car, provides a tremendous amount of coverage that she had no idea about. And so what she said was verbally what the Munger case rejected. She said, we have higher optional limits available for med, and she actually said med or wage loss, which is not true. But what she gave was what was rejected in writing in Munger. And so what's required here is they need to have a process that's reasonably calculated to an informed decision. She needs to understand how the coverages work. That's first and foremost. She needs to understand it. She needs to give the written documents that allow the person to understand what these coverages are. She skipped two of them, used one uncertified form, well, actually two uncertified forms, and the only other form she used, she didn't have the person sign and they had to come back. Is that a process reasonably calculated to lead to an informed decision? Ms. Scoggins bought a lot of optional coverages. Above, she had higher limits than were required by law. Again, you don't have to speculate about what she would have done. You only have to look at whether or not the process would tell her enough of how she could spend far less money. In fact, one other point I want to make. The form she used for the the supplemental application was outdated and not certified, and it never presented her with the PPO managed care option that the insurer had, which had to be disclosed in writing. She never had a chance to pick it because it wasn't on there. The savings on that alone would have paid for APIP on all her cars plus given her money back. So if these things were explained correctly, she might have had a chance to purchase this, even though that showing is not necessary. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time if I could.
You have about a minute and a half left.
Thank you.
You.
Members of the court, my name is John Vaught. My registration number is 9531. And with me, Jessica Simbolinko and I are from Weider Trigg O'Donnell, and we represent Glens Falls Insurance Company and its administrator, Encompass. Let me focus the court, if I could, on what was the critical, and in fact is the dominant question that was presented to Judge Lyman in the first phase of this trial, and that is, would he, sitting in equity, reform a contract to add potentially millions of dollars in PIP benefits not purchased by the policyholder? Because if not reformed, if Judge Lyman did not choose to read in, as plaintiffs demanded, limitless lifetime medical coverage that was not purchased by the policyholder, there would be no breach of contract claim to try to the jury, there would be no bad faith claim, there would be no damages to award. And that because without equitable reformation of the contract, both Encompass and Glens Falls had fully performed, had fully honored every provision of the contract that Terry Scoggins actually purchased. So restated, without equitable reformation of the policy, there would be no claim for relief to be tried to a jury. And so if Judge Lyman, within his discretion, appropriately bifurcated this trial, bifurcated it into an equitable proceeding to address contract reformation, and bifurcated it into an accident law to later be tried to the jury, and if he appropriately ruled that the thrust of this action was an action for reformation in contract, and that that is an action in equity in Colorado, not triable to a court, not triable to a jury, but triable to the court, whether appellant waived a non-existent jury trial right is of absolutely no consequence to this appeal, because you simply cannot waive a right you don't have. So let's go back and look at the order that was addressed by Mr. Carey, the September 4th, 2007 order by Judge Lyman, where he concluded, after full briefing of the parties, that the thrust of this first phase would be in equity, and it would be appropriate to bifurcate these proceedings and proceed in equity in phase one. It is, and by the way, a decision, as I said, that was fully briefed by the parties. But let me deal first with the bifurcation question, because as I said, what he's decided was what's appropriate to do here is create a phase one in which to address the equitable issues, and later we'll come back and we will try all of the actions at law. And so Mr. Carey has characterized the order, but let me make sure the court understands exactly, and I'm reading from page 2004 of the appellate record, and this is Judge Lyman's order I'm reading from. It says, the court grants defendant's motion to bifurcate the trial in the interests of judicial economy and as has been done in other APIP cases. The first phase shall be tried to the court sitting in equity. If the policy is reformed, a jury trial will be scheduled to decide plaintiff's tort and contract claims and the associated damages. That was the ruling of September 4th, 2007. And the question then, when he said, after saying, I'm going to bifurcate, that issue wasn't appealed. That's not before the Court of Appeals. There's been no challenge to his decision to bifurcate these into two proceedings. So once the court ruled in an unchallenged way that within his discretion he should bifurcate, the question is, well, so what's going on in phase one here? Is contract reformation an equitable remedy in Colorado? Is the thrust of phase one in equity? And there's a legion of cases that say, absolutely, that's right, Carter versus Cash being a good example. But the Brennan case, the case on which he provides his foundation, he claims, for the right to reformation, the Brennan case says, the remedy of contract reformation in an APIP context is an equitable one, and the trial court's formulation of such a remedy is within its discretion, page 556. And after all, that's exactly what the appellants wanted, because without reformation, they didn't have a claim for relief. And so to obtain that reformation, what did they tell Judge Lyman? What did they tell him in the very briefing that led to the September 4, 2007 order? And I'm now looking at the brief that they filed in the district court leading to that order, and I'm referring to page 1246 of the appellate record, where the estate says to Judge Lyman that caused him to sign this order, the estate, and I'm quoting, the estate agrees that reformation is an equitable remedy, period, close quote. And that position was reaffirmed three more times. In the joint motion for status conference regarding phase one, in the amended case management order, both signed by counsel leading to phase one, and in the telephone hearing on the very eve of the phase one trial, again, all participating, counsel all participating in the action, but less than 3 weeks before the trial, after Mr. Carey has relieved Mr. Rodriguez as the lead counsel, Mr. Carey comes in and files a motion for jury trial. And Judge Lyman denied it as simply coming too late. But what do they appeal? Not bifurcation. Not that contract reformation is an equitable remedy. But they appeal a comment in that telephone hearing in which, in passing, Judge Lyman says, you probably have waived any right to jury by your late filing anyway. And again, so now the question is, on appeal, what are they appealing? What is it that they're telling this court was the problem? And I'm looking at page 21 of their opening brief in this case. They tell you that here the court set a bench trial on grounds that there had been a constructive waiver of the right to jury. Nothing could be more inaccurate. The judge set this trial for a bench trial for one reason. He found that the thrust of phase one was inequity, and that was the appropriate ruling. But in the end, their failure to appeal the right issue, I think, doesn't matter. Because if, as Brennan tells us, if, as the late Honorable Judge Figa told us in the Hardwick case, contract reformation is equitable, bifurcation to focus on the equitable issue is within sound discretion of the court, whether the appellant now claims on appeal that there was a constructive or express or challenge that there was a constructive express or waiver of the jury in writing is absolutely of no consequence, because they never had a right to a jury trial, and therefore there was nothing to waive. Let me address for a moment the offer issue that Mr. Carey has mentioned. And although I think most of his argument was you should believe his witnesses rather than the witnesses Judge Lyman chose to believe, basically there are two parts to his offer challenge. The first was that there was this supposed alleged omission in the policy. Didn't address non-resident relatives, didn't address pedestrians. First of all, that theory has been completely discredited, both in the 10th Circuit, U.S. District Court. It's now been discredited here in this court, in the Munger case, the Jewett, and in other unpublished decisions of this court. That theory that if there's a problem with the policy, there can't be an adequate offer has been completely discredited in the state of Colorado. But again, as Judge Loeb pointed out, the alleged omission here is non-resident relatives and pedestrians in the policy, or a blank left on wage laws. Well, as you pointed out, Dennis Scoggins was a family member. He wasn't a non-resident relative. It is exactly the kind of questions that Judge Lyman had to address. Is I'm asked to reform this policy. If I reform it as he asks, it's not going to affect anybody who's a party to this claim anyway. And furthermore, the PIP statute provides that if there's an auto accident outside of the state of Colorado, non-resident relatives and pedestrians aren't entitled to benefits anyway. And this accident, as you know, occurred in Utah. Those people wouldn't have gotten PIP benefits no matter what. And on the wage loss issue, the argument is, well, there's a blank that would have been filled in had they purchased APIP coverage. That was the testimony. But Dennis Scoggins was 9 years old at the time of the accident. He wasn't employed. So Judge Lyman is looking at issues that says, look, I may not reform here because what they want really won't address the problem, exactly what happened in Snipes. But let me go to their second theory, that is that they claim on a clearly erroneous standard that there was no offer to Terry Scoggins regarding this. And as I say, that, all of this about you should have believed, he should have believed my witnesses rather than theirs, is subject to a clearly erroneous standard. But the testimony is that Terry Scoggins and Betty Thomas, with whom she had dealt in the past on insurance matter, this wasn't a stranger to her, sat at a table perhaps no larger than the table in this courtroom, and for 30 minutes talked about PIP coverage, liability coverage, insurance coverage, and even Terry Scoggins says, of the 30 minutes, I bet we spent 20 on liability and PIP alone. That was the testimony. And so they, after that 20-minute discussion, 30 minutes overall, she signs two applications. She renewed coverage three times. She received policy mailings that addressed extended PIP coverage, including a notice on the very Brennan decision itself that was provided to her. And in denying reformation, Judge Lyman's findings are not only not clearly erroneous, they are amply supported in the record. But even assuming those findings, all of those findings, there's one that stands out, because what he concluded was the 2002 offering, the mailing, in 2002, 3 months before the accident, that included the Brennan notice, it had cured any alleged defect in the policy. Their expert admits that. Resident, non-resident relatives and pedestrians were specifically addressed in that policy. There is nothing wrong with that, and Judge Lyman concluded that offer alone stands as an adequate offer under 710. And if, in fact, his conclusion is from these findings that reasonable minds wouldn't differ, that's a reasonable offer and gave a reasonable set of opportunity for Terry to buy this, that issue would survive no matter what. It's not dependent on credibility at all. It basically says reasonable minds wouldn't differ, and I think the bottom line is that even if remanded, the outcome would be the same.
Can you answer a question for me?
Certainly.
On the timing issue here? What's the state of the law on when the, in a situation like this where you have multiple policies over a course of years, all of which are essentially the same, what does Parfrey and its progeny say about when the offer has to be made? Did the offer have to be made in 1999, or could the offer be made at some subsequent point?
All that Parfrey tells us is that it's a one-time obligation, Your Honor, and there are cases that make it clear it does not have to occur at the outset. It can occur anywhere along the timeline as long as the policyholder is afforded a reasonable opportunity to buy that coverage before the accident. Two other issues that I think I want to address very quickly that need to be affirmed irrespective of what you do on the remand question relating to juries, and that is, number one, it is uncontested and unappealed that Encompass was the administrator here, that Glens Falls was the carrier, and 710 only speaks to the obligation of the insurance carrier. Encompass should, under any circumstance, be dismissed from this case because it had no obligation to make an offer. Secondly is the $200,000 cap, and the critical question there, and the analysis is, what did the parties intend? As early as Brennan. Okay, if in fact a PIP had been bought, would it have been subject to a $200,000 cap? Is that what the parties intended? And the answer to that is clearly yes. The evidence is overwhelming that had Ms. Scoggins purchased a PIP coverage, which would have covered Dennis because he's a family member, like everyone else who purchased coverage from Glen Falls in Colorado, it would have included a $200,000 cap. And in fact is, there is a stipulation that as a result makes this rather surprising to me that it's even appealed, but there is a stipulation, and I'm reading from page 2533 of the appellate record, in which the plaintiffs said, to ensure that judicial resources are devoted only to issues of fact legitimately disputed and to potentially speed things up, plaintiff hereby stipulates that Glen Falls carrier or company would have inserted the $200,000 cap in the policy if the coverage had been bought. So let me say in conclusion, and I commend to you the reading of Judge Figa's opinion in Hardwick, because what Judge Figa did in Hardwick was exactly, he endorsed exactly what Judge Lyman did here, that, and he did it sua sponte. He said the appropriate thing to do here is to bifurcate the reformation issue from the actions of law and questions of law, and found that contract reformation in the precise context we're dealing with here, precise context, Judge Figa says it's an equitable remedy triable to the court, and as a result, plaintiff had no jury trial right to waive in this case, and the decision should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Butt. Mr. Carey, you've got just about a minute and a half.
Thank you. Insofar as the equitable right is concerned, reformation in this context is mandatory upon proof of a statutory violation. It's mandatory. There is no exercise of equity. It's automatic, and the court recognized this, and in phase two had set the only equitable exercise the trial court would have, which is picking the effective date. So in phase one, there was no right that had to be done in equity. In fact, it was the opposite. It was the Parfrey test. On the Parfrey test, Mr. Vaught wants it both ways. He wants to tell you, oh, you can't look at a policy and pick a defect. The only way to do it is Parfrey. But if you do Parfrey, you're piling in the totality of the circumstances, and it would be impossible to pick a remedy other than just plugging the coverage into the policy, because there will be thousands of factors. If it's the totality, you're talking about the things they use, the language on the cap, for instance, in this case, and thousands of little things that happened in this transaction. So if you want to say that you can't do it by showing a defect in the policy, which is what they did in Clark and Brennan, then you have to also understand that that means you just have to plug in the remedy for everybody. Last point on that, on the cap. Mr. Vaught raised an issue on the cap. I would just say this. There was nothing in the cap. We conceded that. We said they would have put it in, but two things. One, in the application and the policy, they consciously chose to pick a single limit. They removed per person, per accident limit. That alone is a Parfrey fact. And their own witness acknowledged that it would scare people off if in certain circumstances you understood you would get more from basic PIP than APIP. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. That completes our docket for this morning. And the bailiff may announce a recess.
Court will be in recess, subject to call.